You're listening to a podcast from 702 and Cape Talk.
We're going to be talking about cricket this hour. No, don't change the channel. You know that everything in this country is polo tricks. You can talk about the weather, Vetkoek, Boerewors, and around the next corner, there will be interesting things to be said about it in relation to the broader fault lines in our South African society. And I hope that you will enjoy my guests and also call in throughout this hour, engage, give your views, both as a cricket fan, but also just as a South African. We are a sports mad country, and sport is a very interesting way in which to take the temperature of the nation in terms of how are we getting on with dealing with everything from inequity to identitarian differences between ourselves. And so I love talking about sport as one way of talking about the hard issues, but through our love of sport, particularly sporting codes like rugby and cricket. And that's exactly why we thought we'd open up this particular conversation. Okay, so the lines will be open throughout. Cape Tonians, 021-446-0567. And here in Johannesburg, on 011-883-0702. Part of this conversation, we're joined by Professor Eshwin Desai, who's written a lot on cricket, professor in the Department of Sociology at University of Johannesburg. I haven't spoken to you in ages, Eshwin. Thank you so much for agreeing to come on at short notice as well. How are you?
Great, and it's an honor to be on your show.
Well, it's wonderful having you here, and I'm looking forward to your remarks. And here in studio with me for the full hour is someone who's doing doctoral work on transformation in our schools, and obviously sport is one element of that, Lewis Mantata, who is housemaster and history master, very grand English titles appropriate for cricket at St. John's College, but soon to be gifted to St. Andrews in Grahamstown as deputy headmaster there. And he presented a paper on this particular topic at the Wits Institute for Social and Economic Research that flows in part out of his doctoral work as well. Lewis, it's wonderful seeing you again. Thanks for coming to the studio. The mic closer there.
Yeah, thank you.
Lewis, I'm going to start with you. I mean, what is your interest in this? A lot has been written about cricket over the years in particular, but you are particularly fascinated by aspects of cricket history that renders the experiences of black sportsmen invisible.
Yeah, true. I think the game itself was founded on politics of exclusion, on politics of really colonizing African people and really getting them to bind to the code of behavior of Britishness and Englishness. But if you take that very same idea and how it played out in countries like India, you realize that the Indians appropriated the game of cricket, but in return, use the very same game of cricket to not only to liberate India, but to empower themselves economically as a people and as a nation. And I think the key question is, can the same happen for South Africa? Can we do the same in South Africa?
And Lewis, why would we have an interest in even trying to do that? You know, I'm thinking to myself, given the roots of this thing, where cricket comes from, its history, came here with the colonial forebears to the tip of Africa, why are we so desperate for it to be able to play that kind of catalyzing role?
I think there's a perception, the Ali Bacha perception, that cricket only came to South Africa in the 1980s with the introduction of the development program. The truth of the situation is black people have been playing cricket since the arrival of the British in South Africa. It's part of our DNA. It's part of who we are as a people. I think 150, 200 years of rugby and cricket, we've internalized it. And it's important for national identity. It's important for social cohesion.
In what you've dug up, Eshwin, because you have a deep interest in this as well, is there a very important part of the history of cricket that doesn't tell the full story of participation of everyone?
I think there is, but you know, I'm starting to rethink Eusebius. By the way, just let me say, I thought Lewis's paper was just quite incredible, and I learned a lot from reading it, especially the way he delineated the structural barriers to black African players, young players entering the game, and we can talk about that.
Yeah.
But you know, Eusebius, what I'm finding more as a historian, that many of us went to dig up black cricket and black cricket history, and what we did was unintentionally ghettoize that history. So there was black cricket and white cricket, and in a way, they didn't talk to each other. And I think the challenge was is really to start to do a history that is able to integrate black and white cricket, for example. Why do I say that? Because then we can understand, for example, how good or bad Barry Richards was in relation to Yaqub Omar. But what we're doing by ghettoizing it, we can't make this call. And C.R.R. James was brilliant at this, where he was talking about, you know, why do we say this person is a black Donald Bradman? Why is our litmus test? And by ghettoizing cricket and not bringing into the same arena, we start to romanticize our histories either way. So, you know, I think there's a lot of history that still needs to be told, but for what reason is it told? Is it because we want to put an anchor, or we want it as a catapult into the present? And I think what Lewis is doing and what is brilliant about his paper is starting to open a debate about where we are, about both a country and sport, even if it's through the prism of cricket. Well, you know, if you forgive me for saying it, but, you know, why do I say this? Because he doesn't easily fall into the sort of race blind position that it's all about merit and there's no politics in cricket. Neither does he bend into an African chauvinism.
Sure.
And I would argue, from my own experience in cricket South Africa at the moment, there's a set of people who are like your black economic elite, who are involved in the most rabid form of racial politics in CSA, and a kind of narrow African chauvinism that counts black heads in the Proteus team, but can't make the crossover into in which way the government is culpable in ensuring that there's a divide between township cricket and cricket in private schools.
Sure.
And I think we need to open the debate. I mean, I think Lewis doesn't go there. How, for example, the fact that we don't have electricity and toilets in black schools, you're not going to produce a Kagiso Rabada.
Yeah,
we have to face the question straight off. And so you can't have Fikile Mbalula, when he was Minister of Sport, saying, let's ban cricket from the international arena, when he himself is comfortable with not meeting targets.
That's so, absolutely,
you know,
that's, right. Yeah.
You know, and that's where I want our debate to go.
Well, Lewis, let's go there. I think Ashwin is absolutely spot on, right? I mean, you flag in this particular paper, and obviously this is just a small part of your work, you do flag some of the factors, including the socioeconomic ones, that are exclusionary structural factors. I have to admit, I just looked at the lineup of our T20 team, and I was doing what Ashwin is talking about. I would marginally, but not deeply, disagree with Ashwin that that the optics do matter. And I thought to myself, oh, this is cool. Yeah, we have a team of only like two or three white oaks in it. The bowlers are all black. You know, this is very different to the 1990s, the early days of readmission. So here's a big question to you. How do we even determine the success criteria for what counts as transformation?
I think it's quite complex. And I think the issue boils down to the institutional relationship between race and class. I hear where the professor is coming from. Race and class and how players are produced.
Mm.
You know, what structures do we have in place to produce cricketers? He's bringing a very interesting scenario about the environment in which players are produced. And I agree with him entirely. Cricket is a middle class game, even in England. It comes out of the outputs of middle class families. And have we created that middle class in South Africa to make sure that and to understand that cricket is actually not soccer, it's not the game of the people. Is cricket still entrenched in our red brick schools, in our private schools? What have we done to replicate the same system in the townships, but a system that speaks to our culture, a system that speaks to our tradition, like the West Indies, who reinvented the game and understood the game and broke the MCC laws to interpret the game in their own cultural context?
So is Ashwin right, Lewis, that to some extent the fate of cricket when it comes to integration, diversity, is tied to what happens in the macro economy and in our body politic, unless and until you deal with some of the structural facts about society writ large, cricket will, like many other parts of our lives, its fate will be tied to the story of inequality, politics, and everything else in the entire society.
Absolutely. There's an institutional relationship between capitalism and the game of cricket, and it plays out beautifully in South Africa. The type of player you'll produce in Alex is most likely going to be different from the type of cricketer you produce in Sandton at St. David's Mary's College, purely based on the amount of meals I'm getting a day, the type of high-performance coaching I'm getting, the type of remedial action and academic support I'm getting from the school. All those contribute towards the holistic production of a rugby player or towards the holistic production of a young cricketer.
So we might say, Ashwin, in horrible economic speak, that there are exogenous and endogenous factors that explain the state of cricket. Things beyond the control of the board that have to do with the entire society, like inequality. But then surely there's also a range of, there must also surely be a range of things that are subject to their control where we can nail them if they haven't done enough.
I think you're absolutely right. You know, just for me, just following the game, I think revenue streams just internal to cricket are going to be very vital. As you know, test cricket is on the decline and we have failed at the global T20. We have spent tens of millions of rands trying to bring the global T20 to South Africa and we just haven't got it right. And I think there are danger signals there about how money still comes into cricket and how it seeps upwards rather than downwards that we really need to address. The second thing that we need to address is the question of many of the administrators are involved in what the ANC itself calls the change from transformative to palace politics. A lot of black administrators just assume the status and privileges of former white administrators. Same salary levels, the same long rooms, the same excesses of business class flights. They actually don't change the game, but want to use race to protect their position. I think the third and for me the last thing that I want to challenge myself on is that I went to a transformation seminar of CSA, and two things struck me there. The first thing was there was a complete racialization of the debate about what is black African? Where are black Africans batting? Where are black Africans bowling? And the quota system became straitjacketed around a very narrow racial lens. And for me, the three of us here who love the game, here's a danger that I put to people, Eusebius. If we have two great spinners, one a leg spinner that could be a Muralitharan, and one an off-spinner that could be Shane Warne, but they both happen to be of Indian descent, and they bowled in tandem for the Dolphins. The way CSA racial politics is working out is that we're going to have to separate them and put them in different provinces. Is this the way we want to conduct ourselves around cricket and confronting the issues of race and class?
Okay.
I, for one, can't countenance that.
It's 19 minutes after 10 o'clock if you're listening to this conversation. You've heard quite a bit from both Lewis and Ashwin. What is your experience of cricket? How do you view it? Do you agree that it is not the people's game? Do you think it is a middle-class game? And do you agree that its fate in terms of integration, diversity, transformation, whatever your favorite term is for all of those isms, is tied to what happens in society at large? And in general, who do you say that on a cultural level, which we'll still get to in later part of this hour, that there's something also exclusionary about the habits and the norms of cricket as a sporting code? Give us a call, 011-883-0702 in Johannesburg and in Cape Town, 021-446-0567. I think I'm trying to shame you here. Are you a hard taskmaster? Are you coaching cricket?
I do coach cricket when I have time, yeah.
I'll just read this one. Shame. Lewis is very shy, so I'm not going to get him to respond to this, but this is hilarious. You'll give me the answer off-air during the break. Sushin tweets, I once played against Mr. Mantata's cricket team in high school. I was batting. I hit a ball straight into the air, and two of his players ran into each other and dropped the ball. He sent them home. And they finished the game with 9 players. How? 21 minutes after 10.
Eusebius Makaiser on 702 and Cape Talk.
24 minutes after 10, we're talking about cricket, both on its own terms, but also as a way of talking about the country at large. Is it a middle-class sporting code? Is it sufficiently integrated? Is its fate tied to what happens in the structures of society in terms of inequality, etc., etc.? Or are those excuses for the leadership within cricket to do more nationally and provincially as well? Take a couple of your calls and see what my guests have to say about some of your viewpoints. Sonny, good morning to you. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good, thank you.
I was just listening to your radio show, and I come from India, and I have played the cricket on a certain level. What I don't really understand about South African cricket is, like, the thing of, I understand about the race and the culture and integration of the sport, but any kind of sport is about merit. Doesn't matter if I'm a white player, black, colored, Indian. If I have the skill, I need to represent my country on an international level. So it's all about the skill. So are we compromising on skill when we are trying to integrate the team? So is it because if you see the Indian cricket team even now, a lot of the players come from very small towns, and they became role models over there. Mm. And that's how the cricket got money, support. And the whole shabam, it's like we have a word in India, we call it tamasha. It's like a full-fledged show. And that's why it became the most prominent and the most prize-winning sport in India. Mm. Are the South Africans trying to do that?
Okay, interesting. Yeah, interesting viewpoint. What is the current situation? I just can't keep up with changes in policy in all of our sporting codes. Are quotas in place? What's the official position or not? Just answer that, and then secondly, answer for me the general point. There's often a perception that there's a trade-off between representativity for the sake of nation building and all those other feel-good things and merit.
Look, it's interesting that the colleagues Sonny's from India, because even the very Indian society was based on the caste system, and in the initial selection of the Indian team in post-colonial India, certain people were given privilege ahead of the Muslim minority like Muhammad Azharuddin. We know how he was ostracized within the Indian society, and obviously the elites at the time in the 80s, 70s, 80s, Sourav Ganguly himself actually was an Indian prince. So
meritocracy is a lie, firstly.
Meritocracy is a lie, and meritocracy is problematic in the South African context, where 80% of the economy is still in the hands of the minority. Had cricket South Africa not had quotas in place, Kagiso Rabada and Themba Bavuma would not be playing international cricket. That's a fact.
And what's the current position? Are quotas still in place?
The quotas are still in place. The quotas are still in place in favor, and to a large extent, some people can argue that in favor of the minority, to be quite honest. Yeah.
Ashwin, your take on this one?
Well, I mean, firstly, I mean, I disagree with the caller from India. You know, there is a saying by Ashish Nandi that cricket is an Indian game accidentally discovered by the English. But notwithstanding, it is replete with the kind of systematic discrimination against Dalits, and no Dalits get to play in the team for the last 20 or 30 years. Mm. But we don't want to go there. I take issue with Lewis on this point. Mm. The president of Cricket South Africa is black. The CEO is black. The chair of the national selectors is black. That the danger of the quota system now at the national level is we're going to destroy black players, not help black players.
Explain.
Why? Because Bavuma, even if he's off form, he will be selected to keep the selectors happy and the policy happy. And he will never go back and play provincial cricket, come back and be stronger. If Rabada needs to be rested, he won't be rested because it suits the selectors, because he fills what is called the quota system. How dare we call Rabada and Bavuma? Rabada, who the fastest to 150 wickets at his age in the world, just elected between the age of 18 and 23, the golden boy of wisdom, the quota system. I think Lewis is completely wrong. It hurts black players at a national level.
But hold on there one second, Ashwin. I want to challenge you here. Just hold on for me. Calm down a little bit on the incompatibility of affirmative action and merit. This is something in a very different context. I know you feel strongly about it, and I think it's an important conversation for the country and between us as black people. I mean, I used to have deep beef with Jonathan. Well, it is possible for me to be picked to be the first black presenter on 702 and still be excellent at my job. So the description of Ekagiso as a quota player is not incompatible with him being an absolute superstar comparative to all the other greats at his stage of his career. And so I want to ask you this question. Why is the phrase quota player a trigger for you? Is it not because you are actually doing what some races do, which is to define quota as meaning not capable?
No, I take your point, and I react to it in this sense. I can understand that it was through political intervention that Mackay and Tini and Herschel Gibbs came through. I don't think it was through political intervention and political pressure and the quota system that especially Kagiso Rabada came through. Mm. Why do we have to hang another label on a black player? I can understand the fastest black fast bowler to 150 wickets. I'm not discounting that and living above anemic non-racial life. Mm. But I don't want every black player, Keshav Maharaj, everybody, to have this thing called quota hanging over there. He's the quota player. And when does it stop? You know, when is Kagiso Rabada in the team? We might have a quota for some Afrikaans player comes from a rural area like Deu Steyn, where there was no cricket, fine. You know, and it appears sometimes the white players are so hopeless that they are the quota players rather than the black players. And of course, we get some resonance when we see the figures, when we look down the lineup. We don't live in a false world and we see Bavuma made a century. Of course, we are moved by those things, especially given our age and what we've lived through. But I feel to hang that label, Eusebius, so it's different from saying that Jonathan Jansen, a brilliant man, becomes first black dean, but he became first black dean because he was black and there was a better white candidate or something. You know, it gives a very, he was the best candidate. He happens to be the first black dean, but he's not a quota. He's not meeting some affirmative action targets or employment equity targets. Mm. He was the best. Mm. And I understand why he might take umbrage. If I'm the first, black dean at UJ and they said it, I wouldn't take umbrage. But if there's another word that says, and we met our quotas for deans at UJ, I would take umbrage.
Okay. We're going to leave it there. Always love having you on the show. Thank you so much for coming on, Ashwin. Have a lovely day.
Thank you.
Cheers. That was Professor Ashwin Desai, professor in the Department of Sociology at the University of Johannesburg. But Luis Montata is still here with me in studio. And plenty of your calls as well. We're also going to talk about some of the more softer stuff, if you will, the culture of cricket and ways in which that can be insidious and exclusionary as well.
Eusebius McKaiser on your number one news and talk station.
Luis, what's your response there to what we heard from Ashwin? I mean, Ashwin obviously is extremely progressive. He takes racial justice seriously, but he still thinks that actually, even if you do, and it's an interesting position to occupy. So he shares the outcomes that you have for a vision for more inclusive cricket, but he thinks that actually quotas may harm even a very progressive agenda.
The discourse of changing the material condition of the poor white Afrikaner in the 1930s, 1940s was based on the affirmative action program. Bringing them to the same level as their British counterparts was based on the affirmative action program. The transition of rugby from it being an English sport into an Afrikaner sport and being part of Afrikaner nationalism did not happen through the natural progression that the professor is looking for. It's not going to happen. Mm. The change in economy is not going to happen naturally. There is no such thing.
I'm with you. I'm with you on that one. Let's take a couple of calls in a row. Sean, thank you for your patience. How do you want to contribute to this discussion?
Hi, morning, Eusebius. Eusebius, the black children in the townships, what I have seen is that they have awesome ball skills. Mm. Now, why can't we get scouts to go out to these townships and nourish their raw talent? You know, I understand that the affluent schools, Sandton, those areas, you're going to get the good meals, you're going to get the awesome training, all of those things, but why are we not taking those children out of the townships that have got these brilliant ball skills and raw talent and nourish their skills?
You know what sometimes happens anecdotally? Lewis can tell me what the aggregate data tells us in terms of the patterns. I was sharing with my producer this morning what happens in a place like Grahamstown, where you have all these top private schools and good Model C schools, St. Andrews, Kingswood, Graham College, that I attended. You'll get an oak from the township who shows talent to the age of 15. They will be taken from the township. They will go on a scholarship, and they will be boarding for a year or two. They will help Kingswood or St. Andrews or Graham College to do very well in the leagues, in the province, and hopefully even nationally. And then when you go back and you go look at them at the age of 25, then they have these suspiciously thick bodies where they look like they must have been first team players in high school. They've got big bellies and their careers have gone nowhere. They haven't joined cricket clubs, etc. And I think the moral of that, Sean, is that simply taking a talented township guy from the township and putting them in one of these schools, it will help the odd talented township kid to become a Mackay Ntini, to become an Ashwin Willemse in rugby. But it's not going to deal with the structural issue because you haven't addressed all the factors, the structural factors, the sociological factors that explain why it is that a whole generation of talented black kids that have been taken from the township end up just being unemployed, looking half fit in their 20s and roaming the townships again.
But then where are we dropping the ball?
Pardon the pun.
Sure.
It's a very good question, Lewis. Where are we dropping the ball? Because what Sean is talking about is pragmatic. Yeah. But I want to call out private schools. They often are very irresponsible. They care about their rankings in some of these tables. So go get 15-year-old Eusebius. You've played against a township school. You notice that he's got talent. And it's cool for that boy. He is well respected by the other teenagers in the township because now he's wearing the St. Andrews blazer. But if we look at his trajectory over 10, 15 years, he often doesn't have the right scaffolding to become a professional athlete.
Okay, I agree with that. But I need to point out that Cricket South Africa has spent millions and millions of rands going into the townships, providing coaching, providing structures through the RPCs and the hub systems to make sure that players come through. Mm. The truth of the situation is rugby and cricketers in South Africa have come out of 30 schools, 30 boys' schools. What has the government done in South Africa? We have nobody has actually questioned the role of the public purse. Mm. Nobody has actually questioned the role of the Ministry of Education and Sport in recreating institutions that are very similar to the St. Andrews's and those kind of schools. The Afrikaner government did it in the apartheid times. Mm. They built schools like Vattenkloof. They built good schools. Hence the Wessels, the Criniers, and those kind of players came through. It wasn't by magic that those kind of players came through. It was a concerted policy put in place by the apartheid government, probably by militarizing education, by militarizing the schools, and making sure that they channel kids into rugby.
So who should get the lion's share of the blame? Cricket South Africa or the government?
Government.
Okay. Gavin, good morning to you.
Hi there, Eusebius, and good morning to your guest too. My gripe is really about a lot of dishonesty in the language that you use around players and their ethnicity. Mm. You know, and I want to draw a parallel between Ashwell Prince and Mackay Ntini. You know, Ashwell Prince comes from a very working class school where, by the way, I was a teacher. And he comes from a poor background. Whereas Mackay Ntini, perhaps also from a poor background, but he went to Dale. So he had, I think, in my estimation at least, a lot of advantages over Ashwell. But the competition isn't really between the two of them. Mm. The competition is that Ashwell was classed at one, or called at one stage, the first black captain of a South African cricket team when Graham Smith couldn't take the field. Mm. And he was held for that. Then, when Themba Mabuva comes along, suddenly, Ashwell Prince gets relegated to a player of color.
Yep.
And suddenly, Themba Mabuva becomes the first black player.
Yeah.
So there is a dishonesty, I think, in the cricket that is really irking me because it doesn't speak to the real issues.
Yep.
It is playing around, and I think because people are dishonest, there is a lot of people in the cricket world organization who are running cricket for their own benefit. Mm. And they will create issues artificially when it suits them. They will run an Olympics of suffering so they can make a noise to promote their own careers. And I think it's just 100%.
Well, let's go there with Lewis. Lewis, you engage in an Olympics of suffering in your paper because you yourself talk about how many black players since readmission?
10, 11.
Okay. Yeah. Now, when you do that, you are obviously excluding coloreds and Indians.
Yes. Yeah.
Why do you do that?
I understand.
I thought you were black like me.
Yeah, no. I understand the whole dynamic in South Africa around issues of ethnicity and race. But the truth of the situation is that the black African majority came last. They continue to be last. And that issue needs to be addressed. And the truth of the situation is that some of our Indian counterparts are as wealthy as our white counterparts. You go to some of our traditional boys' schools across South Africa, the people who afford the fees to go to Wynberg, to Rondebosch and Bishops are not people from Guguletu and Langa. It's our colored community, it's our colored Muslim community who afford to go to those schools. And then let's ask real questions, let's ask difficult questions. Can we still classify them as disadvantaged? And the truth of the situation is for the black African child, it's not happening. The transformation that we're talking about.
The problem is we can play example table tennis, right? Because there are many colored representatives of our national sporting codes that do come from very impoverished backgrounds. And in the same way in which, not all of them, I mean, you know, whether you're talking Ngidi or whether you're talking Rabada, you're going to have a story of two different backgrounds socioeconomically, for example. Uh-huh. You're going to have the one whose parents were professionals. Mm-hmm. And in fact, there's an expectation that you're going to do something with your life. Mm-hmm. And you would have gone to a very good school. You might have gone to Saints, etc. Not on a bursary, but actually because your parents are middle class. Mm-hmm. Right? And similarly, you might have been in, say, rugby terms. And Ashwin Willemse coming from Caledon, being drafted into a gang, and then eventually find yourself just through being able to run that you get spotted. So I don't know. I'm a bit conflicted here. It is true that marginally more money was spent on Indian communities and colored communities, but the kind of bean counting that Gavin is talking about there is certainly, in my mind, very problematic. Because when it's convenient, we want to say Hashim is a black star, and then when someone comes along that we think is blacker than thou, then suddenly that person becomes the first black.
You see, that's really very difficult, especially in rugby and cricket circles. And I know that a lot of my counterparts would not want to enter this discussion around ethnic differentiation and that sort of thing. And I understand that. But the truth of the situation is, even Paddy Lekgotla, statistician general of South Africa, points out that when it comes to distribution of wealth and that sort of thing, our Indian counterparts ahead, and that contributes into the political economy of cricket. That contributes into who affords the 10,000 rands bet, who can afford to go to King Edward's for an extra lesson every second day.
For purposes of transformation in your work, do you not count an Indian player in provincial and in national squads when you are assessing the question, how transformed is the South African cricket landscape?
There's 90% black African people in South Africa. That's my focus.
So Indians, they're basically honorary whites in your work.
Oh, no. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying I'm accountable to 90% black African people who are still disenfranchised economically, politically, and socially. And on the sports world.
Okay. If you are Indian, if you coloured, do you agree with him? Black for that matter. 011-883-0702. Give us a call. Let's have a lekker debate about this one. Cape Town 021-446-0567. Quick break, then more of your calls. And I'm coming straight to you. And Karen, thank you so much for your patience on the other side of this.
Eusebius Makaiser on 702 and Cape Talk.
12 minutes before 11 o'clock. It's just not cricket. So many people calling in now. Let's hear what they have to say. We are still in conversation with Lewis Mantata, who teaches history at St. John's College, soon off to be deputy headmaster at St. Andrew's College, and doing interesting doctoral work around transformation, the schooling system. And one slice of that work is in relation to sport. And the spotlight today is on cricket. Wonderful, wonderful, interesting South African conversation, this. Anne, you've been very patient. Go straight ahead.
Morning. Cricket, I'm so passionate about it, and I've had guts to phone in. So excuse me if I'm a little nervous.
That's okay.
And just to prove to Lewis why I'm so passionate about cricket, he teaches at the school where the cricket ground is named after my father. So, but that was a long, long, long time ago. But what I want to talk about and what you have said again and again, and I agree with everything that you say, but transformations, and I've had experience of it when I was living in a little town in the Karoo, goes much further back. These kids are talented. They get headhunted to fancy schools and given scholarships and things like that, and where they fall down and they just can't cope is because their basic schooling is so bad that they just can't cope with everyday school life, and they end up dropping out, and that is so sad.
Okay, thank you for that, Anne. Bernard, good morning.
Hello?
Go ahead, Bernard, very quickly.
You serious? I'd like to thank you for this conversation. I think it's a long time coming. And just a little bit of background. I've got a 16-year-old who's come from under 12 playing on the East Rand in Johannesburg for every single representative team, including the Lions. We're under 16 right now. We've come from a rugby, athletics, and cricket background where he represented South Africa in athletics. Mm-hmm. But as far as I can see, that the major problem, as the previous caller said, it comes down to preparation going into the schools. The big schools do a lot of good work, giving the boys an opportunity, especially boys that cannot afford to go to those schools. But as you said earlier, you said that the schools, you find it a little bit irresponsible of the schools plucking the boys and then giving them the opportunity just to keep their ranking up. But the school's responsibility does stop as soon as the boy finishes matric. The other thing that I'd like to see, that from my point of view, is for government to put more money into, into especially the poorer schools, where, because the only way that you can get a boy to excel, especially in cricket, is to put in the hours before the season even starts. We had a boy who is currently at CARES, who his dad used to brag and say that his son has faced 10,000 deliveries before the cricket season has even started. Now, to take a boy in this case, he's a 16-year-old white boy who's growing up, and I'd like to see him play for the Proteas one day.
Sure.
You know, because I've seen him come through and he's got all the talent needed to one day get there. But that's what we need. And the other thing is coaching clinics. Getting 30 boys or 40 boys for a day and getting the stars out to go and bowl to them and play with them, it's a waste of time. Stop doing it. Put the money into the schools. Coach the teachers to be able to coach the boys properly. Because another thing that that you would find is once a boy gets to standard six and he gets to high school, all of a sudden the new coaches has to now teach him how to bat and how to bowl because the basics was never taught.
Okay, that's interesting. Chris, good morning to you. Okay,
hello.
Chris, we'll go to Karen. Hello, Karen.
Hi, sorry.
That's okay, go ahead.
Okay, sorry about that. I just have to make a comment about some comments that were made earlier regarding development within the township areas and in the poorer areas. I run a sports association, or part of it. We do disabled tennis, where we've developed 97% of our players are from rural or remote areas, and we've developed players that are top 10 in the world. It is possible to take players and do programs within the townships, in the rural areas, and still develop the players without taking them out and giving them scholarships at the big schools.
Okay.
It just needs to make sure you work with the schools in those areas and do the programs in the areas where they have the support base.
Okay.
So it is possible, and I think more needs to be invested for cricket into those areas.
Thank you, Karen. Quite a lot there coming up from the listeners. Any thoughts that come up for you?
Yeah, I think we need to understand that traditional boys' schools in South Africa are going through a stage where they're working hard towards understanding a different boy. And that hasn't been done. You know, a lot of people who attended these schools had to arrive at the school gate and actually leave their culture by the gate and assimilate into Englishness, assimilate into this new, different Britishness, which they didn't understand. And obviously, our coaching staff is still largely very white, irrespective of whether a kid comes from an affluent family or not. If he has a choice between basketball, which is largely coached by black masters, and cricket, he's going to choose basketball. And we need to change that dimension. I think this is a challenge to our traditional boys' schools in South Africa, who have a role to play in producing the next tier of international players.
You see, this is very important. This was the last issue I wanted to engage you on. And maybe we must have you back again before you go to Makanda.
Yeah.
That just as we speak in the classroom about the hidden curriculum and the impact that has in instilling values in the boys, and they become a certain kind of character into life, it's a silent thing. It's almost not. It's not even what you teach explicitly.
Yeah.
If I hear you correctly, when it comes to sporting codes, and let's take cricket as the example of the day, it too has a hidden curriculum.
It has a hidden curriculum. Very, very, very much so. It has a hidden curriculum. And that hidden curriculum is part of what Hlonipha describes as
this is Professor Mokoena.
Professor Mokoena, what she describes as post-Englishness. You know, post-Englishness. Some of the British schools are actually moving away from this idea of being an English school. But there are schools in South Africa that are still hanging on to Englishness. Mm. And that Englishness bars a very, very big part of our transformation in education, decolonizing education, and changing.
You know, you made such a tantalizing point. I remember having a conversation once on this platform with Robin Peterson, my good friend, in SAFA. He was trying to generate the discussion about coming up with a very particular South African style of soccer. The West Indies, particularly in the 80s, they decided to subvert the hidden curriculum of cricket globally by coming up with their own style. They were very successful competitively, but they also had a very particular West Indian style of playing, a rapport, etc., etc. Do you think, A, in the 2 minutes left, we can achieve something like that that is specific to us as South Africa? And number two, could we do it in such a way that will help to deal with the social exclusion? Not the material exclusion, but the Englishness that can also be exclusionary.
I think it's possible. And I think we need to look into the institutional, the three, four institutions that make up the game of cricket, how a young cricketer is developed. It's ritual, it's symbols, it's practice, and codes of behavior. And I think if we look and interrogate those and actually look at how we fit them into at the dimensions of the South African society, we can get to those goals.
I wonder what that would look like, though.
Yeah.
Like, what are some of those symbols or codes of behavior?
Yeah.
What in terms of how cricket is played? I mean, everything from, I don't know, the way cricketers are dressed.
Tea.
I mean, who the hell has afternoon tea, for example?
Cucumber sandwiches. Yeah.
So those are the kinds of things that seem like soft elements of the game, but they can actually also be exclusionary elements.
They exclude.
What are you suggesting? Afternoon amagwinya?
I'm not suggesting.
Lewis, let's leave it there for today. I think that is a wonderful promise for a second conversation, because I think what we agree is the equivalent of a hidden curriculum in sport is a massive part of decolonizing and diversifying our school cultures in general. The same will go for public speaking, your philosophy club at St. John's, all of those kind of activities. And maybe next time we'll make the circle bigger and look at other extramural activities. But thank you for coming in today. All the best and congratulations on your new job down in Gravestown.
Thank you very much, sir. Thank you. Cheers.